This is the Book Show on TM Live. I'm talking now to Daryl Bristow-Bovey. He's one of the funniest writers in the country, but also one of great depth and perception. And in my opinion, I think he's one of our finest writers. His new book is called One Midlife Crisis and a Speedo. Thanks for talking to us today, Daryl.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you very much. Thank you for speaking to me and for what kind words.
It's a great cover. Did you play any part in it?
The cover's fantastic, and I played no part in it at all. And in fact, that cover almost had the book get finished, because I was at a certain point of it, and I'd given up. I didn't think I'd be able to finish, and I had all sorts of self-doubt. And I ran away, and I was in Singapore, and I was logging on to my email to write to my publishers and say, look, you know, I'm sorry about all the faith that you've placed in me and all the time and trouble you've invested, but I'm not going to be able to finish this. And they happened to send through that cover in that email download. And it's by somebody called Gretchen van der Bale, who I'd never worked with before, but I loved it so much because it looks like a kind of old, battered, hardcover, secondhand bookstore Hemingway edition from the 1950s. I loved it so much that I realized that I wanted to have a book with a cover like that. So I finished writing.
So you finished writing. I can imagine Steve Connolly having a stroke if you hadn't finished this book. How long had it taken you to write, Daryl?
It's 43 years in the making, because that's how long it took me to get to this particular midlife crisis stage. But really, I started writing it probably May or June. And there was a break in the middle of a month or 6 weeks of pressing and being a prima donna and not writing anymore. But it's probably 4 months or so, but four fairly worrisome and intense months.
It sounds like it. As you say, 43 years in the making, the midlife crisis closing in. How would you define this, the menopause?
Midlife crisis, I think, I mean, I don't think it's an actual physiological thing, although I see there's a study recently that suggests that it is, that there's a kind of a U-shaped curve of happiness that all people go through, and in fact that chimpanzees go through as well in their fossils. But I think it's more about if you haven't examined your life properly and how you're using time and your life, suddenly it catches up with you and you realize how late it is and how unprepared you are for how late it is and how little time is left. And I think that's the crisis, where you suddenly your perception of time and how much time you have in your life suddenly gets realigned with the cruel realities of the calendar.
Do you think it would have been any different if you'd had children? You know, children sort of stand as markers to sort of say, we've been here, you know, we are the time that has passed.
Yes. I often think that it might be different, I think that if you have children, you're probably also more concerned with other things rather than, you know, obsessively worrying about yourself. But I've spoken to friends who do have children, and they seem to think that it makes it worse, because they have a greater sense of their life not being their own and being caught in a kind of a railway track of other people's needs and things that you have to do, and so you don't have the time to tend your own garden and do the things that you persuade yourself are part of a well-lived life. And so they suggest to me that it's worse, because they feel more trapped and more helpless. But so I think everybody thinks that wherever they are, it's always worse than we have anybody else's.
I think there's something to be said for that too. But before we talk about the big swim, tell us about going swimming with sharks.
I've always been a shark fancier. When I was small, I wanted to be Jacques Cousteau. You know, they had the Jacques Cousteau TV show, the Odyssey of Varalt and Jacques Cousteau, and he seemed to have this really good life. He kind of sailed around the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, being French, and you know, drinking wine and eating cheese on his yacht, and then jumping overboard and swimming around. And there was one particular episode where he did lots of swimming around with sharks. And so I've always liked it. Jaws was the first book, I think the first adult book that I read when I was very small and on holiday in Rhodesia, as it was then, because this was like 1978. And so it's sharks has always been something that I've wanted to, I've had an interest in. And so I decided to go, it was on my list, it was also on my list of things to do before I turned 40. And I was on the Indian Ocean and swimming around with these sharks with a friend of mine, and I suddenly realized I wasn't a terribly good swimmer and I was entirely unprepared and it was in a very hazardous situation. And that's the moment, actually, that it occurred to me. I'm making all sorts of strange decisions based on a sense of an upcoming deadline, which was my 40th birthday in 2 months' time. And it was the first time that made me really think that there's some kind of a midlife crisis, an unexamined midlife crisis going on.
Well, Daryl, most people, if they want to go swimming with sharks, they do it in a cage, but you didn't.
I've done the cage. The cage swimming with sharks, and it was great, and in some ways, you know, you get all of the beauty and majesty of the sea. But this was a list, a thing that I put on my list. I have this stupid list that keeps growing longer because I seldom manage to cross things off of aspirations, things I want to do. And one of them, the phrasing just happened to be to swim in the open ocean with man-eating sharks. And so having put that down in those words on the list, that's what I had to do.
I think what was also on your list was to swim across the Dardanelles. And it's hard to understand why you chose this, considering that you'd had like two near-drowning experiences. Why the swim?
Well, that's the things go on the list as I'm reading books and I see something on TV and I think, ooh, that sounds like a good adventurous thing to do. And I must have seen something about Byron, Lord Byron, who swam across the Dardanelles when he was very young, when he was 22. And I think it occurred to me that the Dardanelles, obviously being the narrowest strait of water that separates Europe from Asia, that runs down through Turkey from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. And I think I must have thought, well, this is a short sort of shrimpy poet. And if a short, shrimpy poet could swim across, then, you know, surely this would be an easy thing for me to do. And I subsequently discovered that Byron, despite being a poet, was quite a man of action and also swam across the Bay of Naples and the length of the River Cam and things like that. But by that time, I'd committed to this undertaking. And it felt like being trapped on the train tracks where you are doing the thing. You suddenly, because I couldn't swim before, I'm trying to train in the pool, and I'm not a good swimmer. I don't like swimming. I don't like the smell of chlorine in my hair afterwards. There's nothing good about swimming. And every time I wanted to stop, I kept thinking, yes, but in a few months' time, you have to be swimming from one continent to another.
So you keep going. Because, I mean, I've watched people train and it looks terribly tedious. But, Daryl, I've suspected there's something so epic and romantic about the Dardanelles. I think that's probably what appealed to you.
Well, it is. It's a waterway that's sort of rich in history and myth. And there is a certain romance. You know, a romantic poet goes swimming across and... you know, in ancient times, it was a famous division between the mysterious East and the more familiar West, you know, to the Greeks. And there's so many stories that adhere around the Dardanelles that I thought, you know, this would be what a terrific mental picture of myself standing triumphantly on the far shore, you know, with seawater dripping off me like Poseidon. And so I'm easily persuaded by romantic pictures that have absolutely no chance of being accurate.
Well, I do think that beneath your carapace there is a hopeless romantic going on. Now, look, all right, so you bookend the book with the swim, but in between there's just so much more, so much hilarity. I mean, I'm very hard on books, and I always always dog-ear pages when I find something interesting because I'm too lazy to take sticky things with me. When I'm looking at your book now, I can say almost every second page is turned up because of the humour on the pages. So, I mean, let's take, for example, your take on social media. I mean, Facebook, you think, is like a retirement village.
It is. It seems to me that way. That, you know, if you're going into the world of the social media, you have these various options, and Facebook seems to be the place where people sit around and show each other photographs of their nieces and nephews, and talk about the weather, and and get very worked up about some fresh issue that everyone else has dealt with and forgotten about a month or so ago. It's quite, I find it a restful place to go to Facebook, because everyone's when they are getting het up about something, it's never something that's terribly important. Whereas on Twitter, for instance, it's a ruthless moment by moment, you know, fast moving stream of bloodthirstiness, and I sort of flee Twitter with very grateful for having emerged intact.
Yeah, as you say, it's like the smart kids at a party, and you walk in and you say, "Can I play?" And they go, "No."
Exactly. No, and they've always just made some joke that you aren't party to, and they're all laughing about it. And when you try to find out what it's about, you run the risk of becoming the butt of it.
How did you go with the Tim Noakes diet? I like the way you say you only realized how bloated everyone was until they told you that they weren't anymore.
That's right. All of a sudden, people think, you know, I feel I have so much energy, I was so bloated, I was so lethargic, but now that I'm on the Tim Noakes diet, I feel terrific. And I wasn't aware of this epidemic of bloatedness and lethargy going about. And they were incredibly persuasive, all of these people on the Tim Noakes diet. So you get involved with it, A, so that you can have something to say at the dinner party, and B, because... these people seem to have undergone these radical transformations. It's as though they were, you know, they couldn't walk before, and now they're running. It's some kind of a Nigerian faith healing church that they've all attended, and so you go, wow, they're onto something. Surely I can get me a piece of that. But then you realize in the end that, you know, all diets are just diets, and They're all equally prey to human exaggeration and frailty.
And they're all snake oil, basically.
Yeah.
And talking of that, I also loved the part about cobra blood and sky fruit.
Yes. For some reason, for some years, whenever I travel, I'm a magnet for people trying to sell me aphrodisiacs and sexual performance enhancers. At first, I used to take it quite personally. You know, every time I got a piece of spam on the email, and somebody, you know, or somebody approached me in some foreign marketplace saying, "I know just what you need. You need something that will make your sexual virility improve." I used to wonder if there's, you know, something about me that was giving out a message to these people, but. So over the years, I've tried them out. I've made a collection of herbal remedies and strange exotic unctions and potions, and some of them work, I guess, but generally in a very unpleasant and uncomfortable way.
The sky fruit worked. You wanted to throw open the curtains and say, "Look,
behold," because. Because you forget, it's been so long since you were 16. It's like, you want to say, am I not magnificent? And so, it's a little shameful. I have been getting, incidentally, I should probably say to anyone who's listening, that the small section in that chapter about rhino horn as a tasty seasoning for salads and for your stews and casseroles, not entirely meant to be taken seriously. I've received 3 or 4 bits of hate mail in the last 3 days from people telling me that rhino poaching is a serious concern, and I shouldn't encouraging people to use rhino horn on their cooking. I tried to explain to them that the book hasn't yet been translated into Vietnamese and hasn't been distributed in the Far Eastern countries. But just for safety's sake, if anybody at home reads that chapter and is intending to acquire some rhino horn to sprinkle on their salad, it's probably not a good idea.
Not a good idea. Darryl, I want to talk about the actual writing, because humor's known to be the most difficult to get right. Did you pay a lot of attention to the actual carpentry of it, if you know what I mean, about the timing, or do you write and rewrite, or does it pretty much come out intact?
Well, I think a large part of humour is the rhythm. So there has to be a kind of a, it's almost a spoken rhythm, although obviously, you know, one doesn't speak as eloquently and as fluently as you do when you write. It's an imitation of an idealized spoken rhythm, I think. And when it's coming out right, it comes out more or less intact. Sometimes you have to, I was quite unhappy at first with some of the chapters, and I had to go back and cut away a lot of words in order to make it funnier and to make it give it a better rhythm. Because sometimes when you're trying too hard to be funny, it becomes stilted and complex and wordy, and you can just see that somebody's showing off and straining for some kind of effect. But the problem with humor is that it is hard to be funny, and because you want to be funny so much and you're looking for any opportunities to be funny, you tend to get lazy and reach for easy targets. So, and when you've made a joke, the fact that it's a joke, it strikes you as sufficient reason to be included if it's successful. And the danger there is that you do become lazy, and you let yourself down. I let myself down in some respects by, if I'm not vigilant about it, by reaching for the laugh the whole time rather than thinking about the effect the words might have on people, or what's true. You know, when you're trying too hard to be funny the whole time, you forget about what's true, and you just keep going for what's funny. And I think that's a trap that I try quite hard, especially these days, to police in myself. And when I go back, that's over it. That's very often what I'm looking for.
Well, that policing gives your writing so many layers. Now, in your columns and your travel writing, you show a very wide reading. And I remember years ago, you and I established that we were both Robertson Davies fans.
Yes.
What other books have influenced you?
In travel writing, obviously, sort of Clive James and Paul Theroux and people like that. In my early days, I read a lot of P.G. Woodhouse and Raymond Chandler and things like that for the particular rhythm. With P.G. Woodhouse, almost all of his humor comes from a kind of a spoken rhythm. If you break it down and analyze it, he's not necessarily saying something funny when you're laughing. There's an accumulation of a sense of funniness, and I think he was quite influential early on. Not that I think I write like him, but it's an underlying lesson there. And Raymond Chandler's prose style I love for the unusual metaphors and a concision, a kind of a concision of style that is quite deceptive, because it looks like he's being quite wordy, but he's being very terse. And again, I don't think I sound in any way like Raymond Chandler, but those are the I think you read those things for those kinds of lessons of what's going on.
To go back to what we were saying about the layers of the book, there is so much more going on here than wisecracking. I mean, you write about the death of your father, you write about your ambivalence about your best friend's wedding. So I think it's an immensely honest book, Daryl. And were you anxious putting it out there? I mean, it's a courageous book. Or do you feel you've put things to rest with it?
I suppose I was a little anxious, in a sense. I try very hard nowadays. It's more important to me that something be true, or at least as true as I can put it. In other words, I suppose, honest. It's more important to me that it be honest than it be funny, or than it be something else. If I can get both, then that's great. So I knew that I wanted to be as honest as possible, and those sections, they aren't there for the sake of being honest about something. They're there because they serve the story that I'm trying to tell. But it didn't, when I'm writing it doesn't concern me or make me anxious. But I must have been a little bit, because I asked my editor if he thought that they worked. Not whether they should be there or not, but I get concerned when I'm being revelatory that I'm not being self-indulgent, because there's nothing nothing makes me as nervous or afraid as the thought of putting down a whole bunch of stuff just because you think you're so fascinating. Everybody must share your fascination with the details of their life. I wanted to make sure that they were there to tell, to make a point, and to tell a story, and to work literarily rather than just, you know, here's some more fascinating stuff about me. And I think that was my concern, the handling of that material rather than the material itself. Mm,
I got a sense of you explaining it to yourself in a way.
Yes, I think so. Very often, you know when writing's going well, when you find yourself writing something that you weren't intending to write and that you hadn't really been thinking about. And I think writing works at its best when you make these discoveries. And you're only open to making those discoveries when you are being sort of honest with yourself and you're being quite rigorous about thinking about, is this true or is this just being said for effect?
Mm.
And I think in this book, actually, that the first half, there is a sort of a change in tone, and part of that is deliberate. But there was also a process of discovering things that I didn't know that I wanted to say, but that came through the rhythm of writing it in the second half. And it was in the second half that I became kind of, I thought, oh, well, this is worthwhile. This is what I'm doing is worthwhile.
Absolutely. Daryl, how did you survive the plagiarism case all those years ago?
Well, there were various ways of surviving. The one aspect of it was I was quite. You go into a kind of a sort of a numb state where you don't, where life just sort of goes past you, and you congratulate yourself on how calm you're being and how you're maintaining a stately self, and you're being dignified and all of that kind of thing. But you don't really, I think, recognize the kind of what's going on inside, which is a lot of sort of confusion and shame and anger and disappointment in yourself and disappointment in others and sadness and regret and all of that kind of stuff. And that stuff only really comes out later, I think, when you've had time to work through it. It helped that, because when all of that happened, I was fired from most of my writing, but it helped that I found another career. I became a screenwriter and a TV and movies, and which I went through a process of learning how to do that, because it's not the same thing as writing prose, and it helped that I could do that and I could challenge myself to see if I actually can write, as I suspected that I could write. So many people were telling me that I couldn't, and so it gets into your head, and so going through that process and finding out that actually I could was very helpful. You know, it was like learning a new craft that also reinforced your faith in yourself. But also the main thing is, I think, and the good aspects of it is it forced me to deal with, or examine and deal with, how I react to the world and my relationship with myself. Not in a way that speaks directly to that particular controversy, but that speaks to how I was conducting myself in relation to the world. And I went through quite a long process of, and this sounds terrible, but becoming a more thoughtful person and of being more honest with myself. And of hiding behind public faces and masks and performances less. And that helped me get to a point of kind of just acceptance of life and things that happen and myself and that kind of thing.
Mm.
And so that helped.
Well, you know, you were always a brilliant writer, but it's, your writing has become so much more seasoned now, is the word I keep thinking of. It's richer, it's more seasoned after that, all those years ago.
Well, thank you. I always carried on writing some columns through the last 10 or so years, but they were very apologetic, well, not apologetic, but they were kind of they were pushed aside, and they were of a piece with what I was writing before, which was a kind of very young, brash, striving for effects kind of writing. And then just recently, probably 2 years ago, my publishers approached me to start writing a more public column for their website, the Strake Random House website. And in the process of that, the first three again were similar to how it was before, but there was a turning point at some stage where I suddenly realized that instead of looking for the words and the big words and the funny words and the combination of words, if I would just try and say things as simply and as honestly as I could. And that kind of, there was a bit of a switch in my head and in my writing and in my life to a certain extent.
Well, in one midlife crisis and a speedo, there's wisdom too, you know, towards the end. And I think there's something of it that we can all take away or to talk away from it. I mean, you talk about the danger of trying to look backwards while your vehicle's still moving forwards.
Yes. I think you have to know where you've been and you have to keep in mind where you've been, obviously. Otherwise, it's quite hard to map your route forward. But to obsessively think about what's been before and to tie yourself too closely to where you've been and who you were when you were there tends to be a self-destructive thing that keeps you in a place that everything in your life is telling you you should leave behind and you should move forward from.
I need to wrap it up, unfortunately. I know you're working on a novel. I'm not going to ask you about it, but I do look forward to it. Just a last question. Are you still swimming, Daryl?
I am still swimming. I'm not swimming right now. no, or even this season. But I'll start again very early in the new year. It's you know, it's one of those silly things. You've done something terrific, and so you think, oh well, I can stop now. And so you have to start all over again. But I will be swimming again, and I have certain swimming projects lined up for next year.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to us. That's Daryl Bristow-Bovey, One Midlife Crisis and a Speedo. It's published by Zebra Press, and I suggest that you buy several copies for your friends as Christmas presents.